If you were following the news out of Gaza this summer, you might have heard someone use this analogy to explain the conflict there. One popular version came from the Israeli writer Amos Oz in an interview with Deutsche Welle, a German broadcaster. Oz started the interview with two questions. Question number one.
What would you do if your neighbor across the street sits down on the balcony, puts his little boy on his lap, and starts shooting machine gun fire into your nursery?
And question number two.
What would you do if your neighbor across the street digs a tunnel from his nursery to your nursery in order to blow up your home or in order to kidnap your family?
The neighbor in this telling is clearly Hamas, the Palestinian militant movement and political party that now controls Gaza. The little boy is the people of Gaza. Your house is Israel, etc.
The analogy, of course, works from the opposite perspective, too, from the side of someone more sympathetic to the Palestinian cause. Aladin Attari is a 25-year-old Palestinian-Jordanian engineer living and working in Saudi Arabia.
Let me ask you this. What do you do when a stranger takes over your house and gives you one room to live in, controls everything that goes in and out, eats you and your family, kills your children, and if you resist, you are attacked back and accused of not wanting peace? What would you do if you were in that situation? That is what's going on.
We'll hear more from Aladin later in the show.
Israel and Palestine, two of the world's least friendly neighbors. Today's show is not about filling in the blanks of this favorite analogy. It's about people on either side of the metaphor and the border just trying to understand the folks across the street.
Before we get started on this hour, we need to come out and say something. Talking about Israel and Palestine is new territory for War News Radio. Regular listeners know that we often cover the conflict in our newscast, but we rarely report features about this topic. We believe it's important to break this implicit silence. We know emotions can run high when people discuss Israel and Palestine, so we ask that listeners bring an open mind and heart to today's show. Thanks.
From Swarthmore College.
From Swarthmore College, this is...
This is...
This is...
This is War News Radio.
I'm Sarah Morrell.
And I'm Patrick Hahn.
This month's show, Neighbors.
We collect a wide variety of voices on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict.
Interviews with people as far away as Israel and as near as the lodge next door to our studios.
All that and so much more. But first, a roundup of this week's news. Keep listening.
President Obama gave a speech on Wednesday night outlining plans for U.S. military action against ISIS. Obama called for airstrikes to target ISIS in an effort to contain the terrorist organization, but stressed that unlike the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, there will be no U.S. ground troops deployed. The speech comes after recent beheadings that have caught national attention and brought a demand for action. The Obama administration did not seek the approval of Congress because it defined these plans as part of Congress's previous approval to take military action against the perpetrators of the September 11th attacks. In the light of the anniversary of the attack, President Obama reminded the audience that the U.S. would take the time to eradicate ISIS and aid in the stability of the region.
The Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, a UN watchdog group located in The Hague, confirmed Wednesday that chemical weapons have been used once again on the ground in Syria. After a spate of sarin gas attacks last year, Syrian President Bashar al-Assad agreed to submit the country's chemical weapon stores to the international community for destruction. 12 chemical facilities are slated to be destroyed by the end of this year. According to the OPCW report, the chemical used in this year's attacks is most likely chlorine gas in either a pure or mixed form. While chlorine gas has civilian and industrial purposes, its use as a weapon is banned by the Chemical Weapons Convention, which Syria signed onto last year. In an interview with the New York Times, organization spokesperson Michael Lujan said that the chemical attacks were reportedly launched from high-altitude helicopters. The OPCW report combined interviews with witnesses and victims, medical records, and video evidence to draw its conclusions. The report itself did not make a statement as to which combatant in the conflict orchestrated the attacks.
The majority of Russian troops have withdrawn from Ukraine since the two countries agreed on a ceasefire agreement last Friday. Ukrainian President Petro O. Poroshenko said on Wednesday that about 700 military personnel operating in eastern Ukraine have returned to Russia. Friday's peace deal calls for an end to hostilities, but does not outline a plan for the separatist territories in eastern Ukraine. Though Poroshenko rejects independence for these areas, he suggests that they may receive special status. While Poroshenko and Russian President Vladimir Putin say they are satisfied with the ceasefire, doubts remain about the deal's stability. EU leaders are still considering imposing energy and banking sanctions on Russia, and the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe plans to send specialists to monitor the ceasefire.
Tensions fueled in the disputed territory of Kashmir between India and Pakistan after a flood killed hundreds. As the rescue teams begin evacuation efforts, reports of harassment and violence against soldiers and rescue officials have emerged. One rescue official was evacuated after being beaten by the villagers. As of this week, the Indian Army reports over 80,000 evacuated civilians, and on both sides, death tolls add up to over 450. According to the Indian Defense Ministry, three militants are dead after a 10-hour gunfight between 24 Indian soldiers. Hafiz Muhammad Saeed, the leader of the Pakistani militant group Lashkar-e-Taiba, accused India of water terrorism. This development is the latest in the rising tension between the two nuclear nations.
Concerns over Afghanistan's disputed June 14th election reached a new peak this week with the impending release of a ballot recount. Preliminary reports indicated that former Finance Minister Ashraf Ghani won with 56% of the vote, but contender Abdullah Abdullah has claimed that more than 2 million votes were the results of widespread fraud. This Monday, Abdullah announced that unless enough votes were thrown out for him to win, he would not accept the recount, reviving fears of potentially violent street protests and a possible parallel government. The United States' attempt to broker a compromise between the two sides involved creating a new chief executive position for the loser. However, this plan hit a roadblock with contention over the potential powers that this new position would have. The U.S. has expressed concerns about a plan that was due to be signed on September 5th that would have led to the withdrawal of 20,000 American troops but has been postponed, placing troop movements and funding allocation into doubt. Thus far, the election controversy has led to large-scale Taliban insurgent activity, civil unrest, and over $5 billion in lost foreign investment and revenue due to security concerns.
On Tuesday, seven Shiite rebels were killed and over 45 wounded in protests in Sana'a, Yemen's capital. The Houthis, a Shiite rebel group, have campaigned inside Sana'a for 3 weeks against recent cuts to oil subsidies and have called for the Yemeni government to resign. In the north, there have been 70 deaths after recent clashes between the Houthi and army-backed Sunni tribesmen. Houthi leaders claimed that police opened fire on peaceful demonstrators. However, the Interior Ministry attributed the deaths to armed protesters in the crowd and insisted that soldiers were merely protecting government buildings. The Houthis have vowed to continue their demonstrations regardless of government violence, according to several Houthi spokesmen.
Israeli security forces killed a Palestinian on Wednesday at the Al-Almari refugee camp south of Ramallah in the West Bank. The attack came as Israeli soldiers attempted to capture an activist associated with Hamas. Local youth confronted the soldiers with rocks and other objects. A spokeswoman for the Israeli army alleged that the youth who was shot was preparing to throw an explosive device. This death comes as the Israeli military announced its investigation into possible instances of misconduct within its forces during the assault on Gaza this summer. The military advocate general specified 5 cases, including the shelling of a UN school that resulted in the death of 15 civilians in Beit Hanun and the airstrike that killed 4 Palestinian children on a Gaza beach. This is after Israel has refused to cooperate with a UN High Commissioner for Refugees investigation into the same matter. Human rights groups within Israel have criticized the military investigation, saying that Israel is unable to investigate itself.
Ask a Jordanian where he or she is from, and you are actually more likely to hear Palestine in the first part of their response. More than 2/3 of Jordan's current population are Palestinians who came in successive waves, the 1948 and 1967 war and onward. This is just one example of the complex identities that have formed among the various Palestinian diaspora communities around the world. How do politics and geography mold the perspectives of these second, third, and fourth generation Palestinians? How do they shape their abilities to respond to the events in what many still consider their homes? Aladdin Attari, a 25-year-old Palestinian-Jordanian engineer residing in Saudi Arabia, gives us his perspective on the recent Gaza violence.
Thank you for agreeing to talk with us. How are you?
Hi, Katie. Alhamdulillah, I'm fine, thank you.
To begin with, can you tell me a little bit about the history of your family and how you ended up where you are now?
Okay, well, actually that thing is kind of related to the Palestinian-Israeli conflict because I come from a Palestinian family. That is, we are originally from the city of Benin in the north of Palestine. And most of my family are in Jordan. So I was born in Saudi Arabia. I was raised for the first 7 years of my life in Jordan. And after that, I went for Saudi Arabia, went back to Jordan for the university, and came back to Saudi Arabia for work. So we're from a family that comes from the north of Palestine. We are originally Palestinians. But due to the war in 1967, not the 1948, because my city was occupied in the 1967 war, we were forced to go to Jordan just to flee from the war and from all the killing that was going on. Most of my family lived in Jordan and are still living in Jordan, and my father went to Saudi Arabia to work. But for myself, I haven't seen Palestine before, but I consider myself Palestinian. Palestinian from all the aspects that you can expect. And I feel that I'm connected to my people over there.
From your personal experiences and your perspective, how has the Palestinian community inside Jordan reacted to the past invasions of Gaza, and particularly this one that just ended?
They have acted the same as before, actually. We are not a part of them from the people in Gaza. We are the same people. We are from the same country. We don't feel that we are actually doing them. We don't feel that we are supporting them because we are part of them. We are part of the people. People from Gaza are from my country. They are Palestinian, just as myself, just as all the Palestinians are in Jordan. And we were, for the first time, we felt that the free people around the world, in the United States and the Europe and Latin America, they were supporting us in a very good way. And for the first time, we felt that the free world is standing with us.
What did the reactions of Palestinians in Saudi Arabia look like? And how are these reactions different from the reactions you saw in Jordan?
Actually, the Palestinian people in Saudi Arabia, and mostly all the other nationalities in the Gulf areas, political things are not allowed. You can't make mobs. You can't make a solidarity event or something. This is the rules here, and we respect it. In Jordan, it's a little bit more different. So in Jordan, there was protests against the war. People were calling to close the Israeli embassy, and people were supporting Gaza in many other ways, more than maybe people here, because of the different rules that govern the country.
Thank you so much for your thoughtful answers, Aladdin.
Thank you, Katie. Thank you for coming for this interview, and I'm really happy to talk to you. I really hope that this interview will give a new perspective for a lot of people in the States.
Throughout the summer, calls for Israeli-Palestinian peace were met with headlines of failed peace talks. One perspective on the breakdown of these talks is to consider the voices left out. Where were women in the ceasefire negotiation process? War News Radio's Sabrina Marold explores what women would advocate for if they were provided a seat at the negotiation table, and how the exclusion of women reveals a broader obstacle to post-conflict society.
According to Sarai Aharoni, an Israeli feminist writer and teacher, we need to analyze this summer's Israeli-Palestinian conflict through a gendered lens. When we do so, questions emerge that you wouldn't find in the mainstream media.
Where are women in terms of negotiation, decision-making, representation, and do women have a voice? And here we can think about women as social agents. Then we ask ourselves, what about women in the official political track? And here, we really don't see many women, and especially within the talks surrounding the ceasefire.
The exclusion of women in Israeli and Palestinian delegations in Cairo could be viewed as a commonality, yet the reasons for the exclusion cannot be presumed to be the same. Simona Sharoni, a feminist scholar, researcher, and activist focusing on gender dynamics in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, believes context is critical in interpreting the exclusion.
In Israel, the excuse used to keep women away from the negotiation table was often that they don't have military credentials, because sadly, most of the negotiation took place between people that were either retired generals who were now holding official political office or active duty generals.
While Israel did exclude women from the negotiation table, it is important to remember UN Security Council Resolution 1325. Resolution 1325 calls for the adoption of a gender perspective during repatriation and resettlement, rehabilitation, reintegration, and post-conflict reconstruction. In 2005, Israel was the first country to adopt one of the principles of the resolution into law, highlighting the importance of women being represented in peace negotiation processes. But Sarai Aharoni believes that in the midst of conflict, this resolution is forgotten.
When it comes to the emergency situations, the extraordinary, which is, of course, the most important, that is when it is the most hard to change these patterns. And that is really one of the weaknesses of Resolution 1325, that it is very hard to implement at times when security concerns overcome any other issue. And then we all know that women's issues are always framed as secondary and marginal and unimportant with comparison to territory or army or even collective identity.
Simona Sharoni reflects on how Palestinian women were previously involved in the Palestinian National Liberation Movement and then became increasingly excluded with the rise to power of Hamas.
Women were active within progressive national liberation movements in arguing that their liberation, the liberation of Palestine, is intertwined with the liberation of women, and educating their male counterparts that they cannot try to liberate themselves from the occupation by Israel and remedy that injustice and continue to maintain their domination over women through patriarchy and sexism. And many men grasp that message, and the setback that we've seen is unfortunate.
Both Israel and Palestine left women behind when the delegations went to Cairo. Sarai Aharoni believes that Cairo was also the problem.
Especially because we don't have a serious mediator here like the UN or the US that would have maybe appointed a woman. The mediator here was Egypt. And so we can see how three parties, Hamas or the Palestinian Authority, the Egyptian government and the Israeli government, all three societies in which women do not have a central role in politics and who are dominated by militaries or militias, and militarized masculinity is very powerful. And so we see that in the moment of truth, when a ceasefire agreement is actually being negotiated and drafted, and this is always this emergency situation, that is exactly when women are left behind at that specific moment.
A key distinction needs to be made. Just because women were not involved in negotiations in Cairo does not mean that women on both sides have remained silent. Rabab Abdulhadi and Sarai Aharoni highlight for Palestinians and Israelis, respectively, instrumental women in this summer's conflict. Abdulhadi is an associate professor of ethnic studies and race and resistance studies, and she is the senior scholar of the Arab and Muslim Ethnicities and Diaspora Initiative at the College of Ethnic Studies, San Francisco State University.
As far as the Palestinians are concerned, there we have several ministers who are Palestinians from the Palestinian Authority, including Dr. Hanan Ashrawi, who is very well known. She was a spokesperson for the Palestinians since 1991. And she is currently at the United Nations and the United States, basically lobbying countries to come up with a deadline for ending the Israeli occupation on behalf of the PA.
Where the head of the Israeli delegation was Tzipi Livni, a woman who has been very instrumental in really crafting or attempting to present an alternative that will break the stalemate unsuccessfully. So here we have this woman who headed months and months of bilateral negotiations with Palestinians from the West Bank. And at this moment of truth, she was left behind, or maybe beyond the curtains outside of the main stage. She probably had a lot of consultation to do, but actually sitting in the room, well, we know there weren't any women.
Now let's imagine if Dr. Ashwari and Tzipi Livni were given a seat at the negotiation table. What would they advocate for? Do women see the conflict differently?
Women have their fingers on the pulse as to what needs to happen to address the most immediate humanitarian crisis. I think humanitarian crisis, I think of what's happening on the ground in Gaza right now, the lack of drinking water, the complete destruction of all the infrastructure, the health crisis. Those are issues that have to be discussed at the negotiation table. So women have a much broader understanding of security that is not limited to national security, but really anchored in human security.
That was Simona Sharoni, who believes that because women understand human security, they can bring to the negotiation table discussions of how to rebuild society and conflict prevention mechanisms.
Those resources include elevating poverty, dealing with unemployment, revamping the education system and getting rid of textbooks and partial histories that perpetuate a particular narrative of the conflict that can be deployed and used to ignite the conflict in the future. Creating mechanisms, political mechanisms that are inclusive, not just of women, but also of other minorities within a given society, to ensure that the post-conflict society truly represents all its citizens.
But when we discuss conflict prevention, we need to remember that there is a broader issue. Women are not the only groups excluded from the negotiation process. Rabab Abdulhadi stresses that going forward, a direct connection is needed on both sides between the leadership and their entire population.
If the leadership and any particular community or any particular situation is really representative of the population, of the mass, of the largest grassroots populations and so on, and of their interests, then we should be able to see some differences, because then it doesn't become, the conflicts are not presented as a zero-sum game, the resolution of the conflict is not a zero-sum game. It is about actually achieving justice and achieving the well-being for all populations.
In the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, women are an avenue for understanding the multitude of voices left behind when Israeli and Palestinian delegations discussed peace negotiations in Cairo. On both sides, in post-conflict societies, all voices need to be heard. For War News Radio, I'm Sadie Rittman.
Sometimes it's hard to listen to the news without getting angry. War News Radio's Sarah Morrell and Jay Clinton have stopped trying. War News Radio proudly presents Filibusted, an editorial segment for all the news that makes you want to tear your hair out.
We know that we've talked about Putin a lot here at Filibusted.
And there are only so many times we can mention the man who cares more about whether he can host the 2018 World Cup than the new sanctions coming out of the recent NATO summit.
So maybe we should try something a little different. Hating on Putin has gotten a little too uncontroversial.
You're right, Sarah. And so, Filibusted is finally willing to join the ranks of pundits, academics, and celebrities far more famous than we are who get accused of sympathizing with terrorists for even daring to show empathy towards people living in Gaza.
I don't know, Jay. I'm not sure if I'm ready for that sort of backlash. I mean, even cute little pop singers like Selena Gomez are getting yelled at for posting a photo on Instagram with the tagline, "Pray for Gaza."
How can you hate someone who made their acting debut on Barney and Friends?
Yeah, but that Instagram post alone was enough for TMZ to write a charming article with the title, "Selena Gomez, pro-humanity or pro-Hamas?"
We, for one, would just like to say how happy we are that TMZ is breaking into the field of serious political journalism. Just think of the possible stories they could cover.
How to instigate civil strife in 5 easy steps.
Finding the right military arsenal for your body type.
Ruthless despots, they're just like us.
Now, Sarah, I thought we promised to lay off the Putin jokes for once.
You're right. We're trying new things here at Filibusted this week. Anyway, Putin's not the only one that crosses lines in the realm of international diplomacy.
Filibusted wants to be clear that we are by no means experts on military strategy or international tact.
But Israel's response to 5 Latin American countries withdrawing their ambassadors in protest of recent fighting in Gaza shows that Israel never attended finishing school. Israeli Foreign Ministry spokesman Yigal Parmar had the social grace to call Brazil a diplomatic dwarf that causes problems rather than contributes to solutions.
Don't worry, though. He was kind enough to send an apology note. Eventually.
I personally was disappointed that he didn't remember to attach flowers.
That wasn't the worst of it, though. In a later interview, Parmar alluded to Brazil's somewhat unsatisfying loss in the World Cup semifinal.
Way to kick a nation state when it's down.
I believe Palmore's exact words were, "Israel's response is perfectly proportioned in accordance with international law. This is not football. In football, when a game ends in a draw, you think it's proportional. But when it finishes 7-1, it's disproportionate. Sorry to say, but not so in real life and under international law."
I really don't think he gets to talk about international law at this point.
And sure, UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon and other high-ranking officials have condemned Israel's actions over the last few months, but how far can the UN really go when 22% of its 2013 budget came from the United States?
And we all know that Israel is one of the few cases where American politicians and news networks hold hands, sing kumbaya, and fail to pay attention to multiple perspectives.
Well, that can't be true. We don't see Democrats and Republicans agreeing on anything. Surely if pro-Israel policy has a history of being backed by conservative politicians, there must be dissent from leading liberals in Congress. Let's see what liberal icon Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren has to say.
When asked about her vote to increase defense funding to Israel during the attacks on Gaza, Warren said, quote, "But when Hamas puts its rocket launchers next to hospitals, next to schools, they're using their civilian population to protect their military assets. And I believe Israel has a right at that point to defend itself."
Well, okay, Elizabeth Warren might be running for president. She has to modify her statements to appeal to the general public. But there have to be some liberals speaking about this in Congress. That's why we have a progressive branch, right?
Actually, the Senate voted 100-0 on the vote to increase military aid to Israel. So I think your naive liberal dreams may be crushed.
That's impossible. This Senate couldn't vote 100-0 in favor of a bill to provide sick children with puppies.
There would be too much controversy over whether the children were mooching on the taxpayers' dime.
Or if the puppies were secret Kenyans.
But Jay, this particular Senate vote was so important because of the massive imbalance of military might between Israel and Gaza.
Yeah, your classic underdog story. Israel is able to use upwards of $250 million to power its Iron Dome, which literally shoots missiles out of the sky, while Hamas relies predominantly on weapons smuggled from the Soviet Union.
Clearly the solution is for them to take a page out of Russia's book and use their money to start training spy dolphins.
But for many, both in the US and in Israel, the concern was not just rockets, but the discovery of tunnels that allowed someone to smuggle weapons straight into Israel.
The irony being that the tunnels were initially built to smuggle daily necessities into a region whose economic activity has been strangled by Israel.
Israel argues that these tunnels, regardless of their intended purpose, pose an unprecedented threat because they allow militants to bypass the front lines entirely and attack civilian areas directly.
In this way, these tunnels are completely unlike, say, Israel's airstrikes, which have never been aimed at civilian areas.
But there is an easy solution to destroying these tunnels. For example, the U.S. can always call its resident traffic cop. I'm pretty sure Governor Chris Christie would have no qualms about shutting down traffic through these tunnels.
Oh, so Bridgegate was actually Chris Christie's way of sending his resume to the IDF.
Touche. For Filibustered, I'm Jay Clayton.
And I'm Sarah Morrell. It's been a pleasure, at least for us. Rawan Yagi is a young fiction writer from Palestine who grew up witness to the vicious cycle of violence in Gaza. Her art has imitated a life of pain and perseverance, but she hopes that her writing will move people around the world to take action against the suffering of millions in Palestine. As she continues to publish her work and her audience grows, she dreams that one day her work and the rising voices of Palestinian youth will not only imitate life as they know it, but will change life for future generations of Palestinians. War News Radio's Rachel Yang reports.
Gaza Writes Back, Short Stories from Young Writers in Gaza, Palestine, is a collection of stories published earlier this year by Just World Books. The collection features short fiction from 15 young writers living in Gaza. Published 5 years after Israel's Operation Cast Lead, the 23 short stories are narratives of destruction, loss, and resilience. Rawan Yagi is a student from Gaza, currently attending university in Oxford, UK. She contributed 3 stories to the collection. The one we're about to hear is titled Spared. It's the story of a young boy who sees his neighborhood devastated by bomb blasts.
In a second, a huge light flashed right in front of me, and I was thrown back to the wall of the kitchen and then to its floor. Bricks hit the ground and smashed glass followed seconds later. My knees and hands were shaking, and I couldn't stand up for a moment. There was a strange noise in my ears that sounded like a very annoying non-stop whistle. Smoke was suffocating me. My mom ran to me, crying hysterically. She checked every part of my body to make sure I wasn't hurt. Then she hugged me. But I did not care. I wanted to see what happened to my friends. She immediately pulled herself up and carried me out of the house because smoke kept rushing in. My hands were shaking, and my mind couldn't let go of the fact that all of my friends were playing in the street seconds ago.
Rawan, thank you so much for sharing your work with us. When did you begin writing fiction?
I started writing when I was 16, right after the 2008-2009 offensive on Gaza. I basically adopted the point of view of a child or several children, and tried to focus on that because I felt that the narrative at that time did not give that area as much as it needed. Everything was mostly reports about numbers and economical damages. Very little was said about the psychological effects on children and on young adults.
Do you prefer writing fiction or nonfiction?
I prefer fiction.
So the whole collection is works of fiction. They're not essays or articles. What do you think that the effect of that is?
I think fiction is a more universal tool. It reaches everyone. I think it breaks down all of the boundaries that we build because of our backgrounds and because of where we come from, our societies.
Rifat Alrir, the editor of Gaza Writes Back, agrees that fiction assumes a powerful role coming from conflict areas.
I teach at the Islamic University of Gaza. I teach creative writing and literature. I thought of a way to help my students make sense of what's going on around them, to help them heal, to help them come to sense with the very insane situation around them. So I started assigning them, asking them to write creative pieces. In our classes, short story classes or the novel classes, we would read the world literature by American writers, by British writers, African writers, Asian writers, Russian writers. And we would always comment on the pieces and see how writing as a very creative way of coming to understand yourself and at the same time to reach out for the world, for others, for people around you, as a very civilized, non-violent way at the same time of resistance to the occupation.
Yagi also notes the therapeutic effects of writing fiction. Sharing others' stories, she says, helped her to process the turmoil in Gaza after Operation Cast Lead.
When the offensive ended, I couldn't believe that I was still there with my family, and I couldn't believe that I still had all of my friends. So writing, I think, allowed me to, you know, cope with my, what they call survivor's guilt. I thought that I didn't experience any of the really horrible experiences other experienced, and I thought that writing could make me feel better about it. It did make me feel better, and I did feel like I've done something when I received people's reactions, when people read the stories, and I felt that this is what should be done. These stories should be out there because they are real stories. All I did was just put them in a narrative, in a certain style.
Yagi has seen and heard reactions from a wide variety of readers. This summer, she, Alarir, and another writer whose work appears in the collection took Gaza Writes Back on a book tour across the United States. The writing process that began as a coping mechanism has become a way to bring human voices from Gaza to a new international audience. Alarir says he hoped the book tour would be educational for readers, but found that the many conversations he had with audience members were an enlightening experience for him as well.
We met so many people in campuses, in churches, synagogues, community centers, old people, young people, students, Muslims, Jews, Christians, people from all ethnicities. And that was very, I have to admit, was very enlightening and educating to us, probably more than the people we met, because I personally have never been to the United States. That was my first experience. And coming in touch with those people who are willing to listen to you and to talk to you and to discuss and have constructive dialogue was wonderful, was amazing, was a thought-provoking experience too. The tour was successful in every sense of the word because of its diversity.
Yagi agreed that the tour was impactful for both her and her audience.
The work was received very, very well. I've seen people in the audience, you know, dropping tears when we were reading or speaking. And I felt that if we can touch people's hearts, then we've done something.
Gaza Writes Back celebrates the literary voice of a young generation of Palestinians, but it also raises awareness worldwide of the many stories that so often go untold in times of conflict. Alarir says that these stories could have a mobilizing effect.
As a creative writing instructor, do you feel like this publication is more a work of art or more a work of activism?
It's a very difficult question, and at the same time, it's very profound. I would consider this as a work of literature. It's short stories, pure literature, universal, humane, full of humanism, a book that transcends borders, transcends race and age and language and everything. But at the same time, when I say that this book aims to transcend borders of all race and religion and everything else, I also see this book promoting action, positive action, like, okay, you read this story, you're moved, you shed tears because you identify with the victim here, and you're supposed to ask a very important question, which is, what should I do? What's next? Should I leave this happen again and again and again, or should I take action?
Unlike Alarir, Yagi says she doesn't see herself as either an artist or an activist. Instead, she hopes her stories speak to the human experience.
My three stories in the book, they're not set in a certain place, so that if someone's reading them and they don't know, you know, that this book's about Gaza or 2008 offensive, they could be anywhere. I'm going after a more human aspect than a political or a national one.
Young Palestinians like Yagi are among the strongest voices coming out of Gaza. Alarir hopes that future publishing opportunities arise for young activists and artists to share their voices with an international audience. He is currently working on another collection of creative writing based on the violence in Palestine this summer.
It's high time now that Palestinian young people are given the chance to take the initiative to lead the struggle in so many ways so that we can find a way out of this horrible, horrible situation.
For War News Radio, I'm Rachel Young.
Lining a quad on the eastern edge of Swarthmore College, there's a row of six little houses. They're called lodges. The first four are dorms housing students. Just around the corner, the fifth is home to the Beit Midrash, a library of Jewish texts, and also a gathering place for many religious student groups. Lodge 6 next door is our humble home, the studio and office of War News Radio. The front doors of WNR and Beit Midrash are so close, staffers working downstairs in our lodge often stand up to answer a knock at the door from visitors outside of theirs. In fact, our lodges share a wall, and if you look at that wall, you will see the molding for a doorway now boarded over that once connected the two buildings. Personally, War News Radio members might attend Friday night services next door, or have friends that do, but on the whole, WNR is pretty disconnected from our nearest neighbors. That started to change last fall. One of the student groups that uses Lodge 5 is Swarthmore Hillel, at the time a chapter of the Jewish campus organization Hillel International. Over a year ago, some members of Swarthmore Hillel were reading through Hillel International's Standards of Partnership when they saw something that did not sit well with them.
You know, you can't bring speakers who, or partner with groups who delegitimize, demonize, or deny the right of Israel to exist, support boycott, sanction, divest efforts against Israel, and a couple of other things, too. That sort of raised red flags for us.
Joshua Wolfson is in charge of outreach for the group, which officially became the first open Hillel in the country last year. In December, the Swarthmore Student Organization sent a letter to Hillel International announcing that they were willing to host events with groups from multiple perspectives regarding Israel-Palestine.
If we are going to talk about Israel and Palestine, we should have open discussions about Israel and Palestine and really like create a safe and open environment for us to all challenge each other and really talk through these things.
But Josh says the funny thing is that until last fall, Swarthmore Hillel had agreed, at least implicitly, to do exactly the opposite of what it ended up doing. It had agreed not to talk about the conflict in Israel and Palestine at all. And he says that solution is not uncommon among Jewish communities.
At my synagogue, you know, growing up, I went to a discussion on Israel and Palestine, and it just devolved into a screaming match. Folks who were critical of Israel would often get really demonized and ostracized from the Jewish community. There was this line that was drawn around what it means to be Jewish, and it involves Israel. And that's sort of what has happened. Over time, slowly, as a Jew, I certainly was like, you know, I didn't want to ever say anything too critical. I didn't even want to really think about it, because it's like, Israel is good. Period.
As we were reporting today's show, we heard people talking about, well, how difficult it is to talk about this conflict. Timmy Herschel Burns is a sophomore at Swarthmore and a member of Students for Peace and Justice in Palestine, an independent human rights advocacy group on campus. His older brother was also a member.
Maybe my brother would bring up something SBJP did, and my dad's professor, so he would have some input of how he sees the topic. My mom is a very sympathetic person, and she'd think how awful it is for the people involved. Then if my grandmother's there, so this is my mom's mom, and so she was forced to leave Germany because of the Holocaust, she'd say, I understand, but can't you deal with any other issue? She just feels vulnerable. Obviously, she's felt anti-Semitism in the past, and she doesn't like us to criticize Israel.
The trouble with talking about Israel and Palestine, Timmy says, is that something as simple as word choice can make people feel that their identity as Jewish or Palestinian or Israeli or any overlap or other group is being challenged.
For example, in my family, sometimes people will say Israeli-Arab conflict, and I try to remind them not to say that because personally I feel like that denies Palestinians' national identity, and it does have implicit political meaning, even if the person that said it didn't intend that.
So having an open Hillel at Swarthmore begs an important question. Is it easier to talk about Israel and Palestine now? It's fine to gesture to opening up and speaking out, but what exactly are people saying? In the past year, the number of groups at Swarthmore actively talking about Israel and Palestine has multiplied. Newcomers include an Israeli cultural club, a Palestinian cultural club, and a chapter of J Street University, a Washington, D.C.-based lobbying group that advocates a two-state solution. Hillel and SBJP are also in the process of redefining themselves on campus. This month marked the first test of how these groups will coexist. Seven clubs, Hillel, SBJP, J Street, the Swarthmore Islamic Society, two Christian groups, and the Israeli Cultural Society all agreed to sponsor a candlelight vigil for victims of this summer's violence in Gaza and Israel.
We will now pass a round of flames, and in doing so, we will join together in mourning, remembrance, and recognition. We invite you to embrace the challenge of finding common ground in mourning or commemoration.
That was Maddie Feldman, a sophomore at Swarthmore and a member of J Street, speaking to the approximately 75 students who attended the vigil. After her introduction, leaders of each group stood to offer prayers, read reflections, or lead a song. Later, the event transitioned to an open mic forum. On the one hand, says Timmy, the groups agreed ahead of time that the vigil should be non-political, that it should be a place for people to commemorate the loss of human life, not to promote a platform.
The other part of me was concerned that it would become like mourning the victims of tsunami. It just happened. Like there was a big wave of water and these people got washed away. When that isn't the case, because there are politicians who are commanding armies or economic policies which have huge impacts on people's lives. And when people died, people's actions contributed to it.
And that's the essential problem. The groups share the consensus that in order to work together, they have to ignore their political differences. But they can't help but feel that denying the political nature of the conflict will never lead to a solution. Jamal Dilman Hasso, a senior and Arab-American at Swarthmore, doesn't think that the event was apolitical. Jamal, who spoke during the open mic section of the vigil, says he was impressed by how well-organized and inclusive the event ended up being. He believes it clearly served a political purpose.
I think that the idea of an event that tries to be quote-unquote spiritual and emotional as opposed to political, I think that it's a little bit delusional, actually. I think that when we're talking about something like Palestine or Gaza, everything is going to be political. And if you say you're not going to be political, that's political. If you say you're not going to be political, then you're complicit in the occupation.
Others were more optimistic about the significance of the vigil. Many of the students who spoke during the open mic expressed how lucky they felt to live and study in an environment where people from such opposing views felt comfortable coming together at all. Here's one freshman speaking at the vigil.
I'm not here as a Zionist. I'm not here as an anti-Zionist, as a Palestinian, as an anti-Palestinian. I'm here as a Swarthmore student, and I just wanted to take a moment to appreciate how remarkable this gathering is right now, that people from all faces, from all sides, are able to be here and commemorate the loss of life, not Palestinian life, not Israeli life, not any, just all life. And I think that this really shows the stepping stones, the potential that we as Swarthmore have to create peace.
That's our show for this week.
War News Radio is a production of Swarthmore College.
Visit us online to listen to archived shows, learn more about the program, or subscribe to our podcast. That's at warnewsradio.org.
You can follow us on Twitter and Facebook to keep up with War News Radio between shows. Look for the links on our site.
Our behind-the-scenes crew this week includes Jay Clayton, Anita Desai, Rachel Diamond, Amy DePiro, Matthew Donaghy, Leo Elliott, John Gagnon, Evan Grennan, Patrick Hahn, Allison Raybar, Catherine Huang, Nemet Kaur, Joe Landis, Sabrina Merold, Guangchun Ming, Sarah Morell, Jerry Quinn, Sadie Rittman, Rachel Sasella, Amber Sheth, Zoe Werben, and Rachel Yang. Our piece editors are Amy DePiero, Patrick Hahn, Sabrina Merold, and Sadie Rittman. I'm Sarah Morell.
And I'm Patrick Hahn. Until next time, thanks for listening.